going to talk about the power of communicating without any words today. We'll touch a little bit on the introduction about using words, but generally we'll talk about communication without words. Let's join together in a word of prayer before we start. Dear God, our words by themselves can be haughty or hollow, meaningless or insincere without the leading of your loving Spirit. Open our hearts as well as our ears to receive whatever message you have for each one of us in this hour together. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit in an introduction about words. Then we'll go into saying it without words, which is nonverbal communication. And then saying it with a touch. If we have some time, we'll touch on ministry of listening also, but generally in the first two areas. I'd like to have you ask questions if what I say isn't clear, and raise your hand if you can't hear me also.
Well, you haven't quite had to...
I think she's in there already running it. Would you kind of double check for me? We'll just pause for half a minute to see if we get a clearance on that. While she's doing that, could I ask someone if they will be a timekeeper for me and let me know when... Okay, two things. Do you have a watch?
Yeah.
Okay, in 10 minutes before, huh? 5 minutes before? Give me that.
Oh, second. Okay. What time is this supposed to be over?
I would guess at 11:45.
Well, 1:45, so...
So, 5:25, and then I'll know.
Okay.
I'll appreciate that. I won't worry about that. Are we all right? Yeah, we're fine. Thank you. Okay. A little bit on the introduction. There's a phrase that I like very well, or a saying. I know you believe you understand what you think I said. But I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant. I like that. I've got it on my wall. And I find that even in writing where I can double check what I have written before, I think I know what it says. Then I ask my wife Lois to double check this for me, to go over, we do this for each other. And she says, well, now in this sentence, do you mean this or this? I say, it's obvious, you know, this is what I mean. But, she said, it could also mean this. And sure enough, you know, that's true. So oftentimes we are of the opinion that when we transmit something, that we have, you know, just by saying it, we've communicated. Actually, at this moment, I am not the communicator, though somebody walking in the room might say, you know, Ken Erickson is communicating. But that really isn't the case. I'm emitting. And if you're not picking it up, then there's no communication. There are, as you and I know, radio waves here. There are stations sending out, you know, words, music, and all that. Are they communicating? Well, not to us, because there are no listeners, no one picking up on those. Okay, I have a handout for you, but before we get to that, I want to ask you a question. We have a quiz, you know. All teachers have to do quizzes. Why don't you make a guess as to how many definitions there may be in a big dictionary of the word open? Any figure?
15.
15? Oops. Okay, how about the word ran? 5? 8. Set, S-E-T. 25. Talk. How many different definitions of talk would you guess?
It's been a different language.
Take a stab at it.
6.
10, 6. Well, 10 and 6 will make it 8, huh? Touch.
12.
Okay, thank you. Now, of the 500 most used words that we have in the English language, what, on the average, do you think would be the number of definitions we might have? 500 most common words.
Of each one, on the average?
Yeah, on the average of each one. Each one, per one word.
7.
Okay. Thank you for your contributions. Now let's kind of double check ourselves and see what we have on there, huh? Open in an unabridged dictionary has...
Any two.
Ran.
Oh.
115.
You're one off.
I'm one off, am I? Thank you. You know all the help I can get. 115. And then we have 35. And then we have 60 for touch. And of the 500 most used words in English language, an average of 28 definitions. I guess one quick aside is what must it be like to learn the English language, you know, as coming from another country? But still, this gives you some feeling of the problem we have, because I can say something and I'm thinking of definition 101 and you're thinking of definition 12. A real challenge for us. Okay, why don't you just pass these around? I will follow some of this information at times or refer to it, not just as it shows, but it will be something for you to take with you and see how we're doing. Now, the next, and one of the major areas will be this idea of communicating without words in a non-verbal way. That's really shown... No, I guess I'll go back just a minute to one other thing here. And that's item number four under introduction on the left-hand side when it comes around. Ideas transmitted through a series of individuals may get distorted as much as 80% in the process. You remember playing the game of telephone?
Yep.
And what you start here and what comes out over here, very, very different. I've done seminars which include some work on communication and we have a picture we put on the screen. And five people step out of the room. Now, one stays in, looks at it, or one of them stays in, looks at it and reports after a couple of minutes to the first one that comes in the room. And then they report to the second one that comes in the room until you've gone through five people. You would be amazed at what comes out as opposed to what went in. All the wisdom and the know-how in the world is no good. This includes probably the good news, huh? Unless you can communicate successfully to others. And we depend a lot on the type of communication, now that I'm doing, just verbal. But we oftentimes fail to share enough information with other people. And when we fail to share enough, what happens? In an organization, rumors start down the grapevine. And sometimes I think we fail to share the word verbally as well as non-verbally. Talking is easy, communication is difficult. And I guess we as parents ought to remember that as much as anything else. We can talk and over-talk, huh? But we're not always communicating except sometimes a negative attitude. And when we talk with each other, when we talk with our neighbors, we talk socially, are we communicating froth or is there substance in what we communicate? How many more times will we see these people that we probably have some substance to communicate with them, but we fail to do it? And then sometimes it's too late. Okay, now I'm going to... Did those papers? Yeah, they got around. Here we are. Okay, now I'm going to move to the backside. It says saying it without words. But I'm going to cover some material. Incidentally, I didn't mention, Jody mentioned this morning, but a lot of this does come from, most of it comes from a book called The Power of Communication by Concordia Press. which is due out in July 1986. And I'd ordered some to come up here, and they have not arrived. I hope they will soon. I know they'll be out next week because I'm going back east to the Christian Booksellers Association and in relation to the book, and they will have to have them or it's no use going. Okay, communication without words.
Did you write this book?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Can you tell us otherwise what you do professionally?
Yeah. Professionally, I was in the field of education most of my life. High school teacher, counselor, principal, superintendent, and campus, University of Oregon. And then a couple of years ago, retired and found out that since my wife was writing, I tried it. And someone asked me what other books I've written. I'll mention it at the end. So that's where I am at this point, huh? Incidentally, the 21st year up here at the Village. So we love it. I guess you can tell by that. Okay, this ties in, incidentally, it's almost like it were planned. I don't know if you can do this or not, but thinking of last Sunday's message that Carol Nolte gave, you know, her holdenization of the Good Samaritan story, those of you who heard it. This morning's matins, other things that have been said down the line, all kind of tie together, it seems. Mary's matins I was thinking of this morning. So we remember that it is not everyone who keeps saying to me, Lord, Lord, who will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who actually does the Heavenly Father's will. Doing again. One of my first examples when I've used something in the area of communication deals with Holden Village. Years ago, and I was not here at the time, I was told that campers or some hikers came down the trail from Cloudy Pass, and you know how thick the dust can get when it's hot in the summertime. They were hot and dusty. And that some villagers, instead of saying, welcome to the village, sat them on the rock wall out there with basins, soap, and towels, washed their feet. That is telling and compelling nonverbal communication. They couldn't have said, welcome, happy to see you, and had a similar or helpful effect in any other way. And I wonder sometime, what if somebody came in now and said, hey, we'd like to wash your feet. How would we react? Are we willing to accept that type of service from others? Some accepted it from Jesus. We are, you know, probably servants of the servant, if we think of it in those terms. Thinking of nonverbal communication again, I kind of hate to share this, but I might as well. I don't know what your neighbors would say and know about you through your actions, or at work, or wherever. But I remember one time after working one place for a number of years, someone said to me, oh, I didn't know you were a Christian. You know, what had I been communicating non-verbally and apparently nothing verbally either in that interim period of time? And then we often send two messages, the verbal message and the non-verbal message. Can you think of any situation where you've seen somebody and what they say and what they do conflict? Any example you can give, or for us?
Just a common one is when people ask people, how are you? And people respond, fine, if they're not.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they're maybe I'm like this,
right.
I'm fine.
Well, I'm fine.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I was in the bank the other day getting ready for this vacation, and a woman who was there waited on me before we had gone. And she smiled at me, and I gave her my check, and she said, can I give you two $50 bills? And I said, no, I'd rather have 10s or 20s. And she said, well, after all, it's only $100. And that's all she had to say. And I suddenly felt like, she doesn't want to go to the trouble to count up 10s. And I felt just awful. She made me feel just terrible. I just thought, I'll never go to that window again if she's there. She made me feel wrong. I was wrong. I should have taken the $250 bills. In fact, I started to say to her, that's all right, I'll take the $250. Yeah. It's going to upset you, you know. Uh-huh. It was just, and I felt really diminished. I said, why? That was such a small thing, but it was really the way she said it. Yeah. It was a disturbance to her that I didn't take her suggestion.
And there was probably a sign beside them, we served you well, whatever the bank motto was.
She smiled at me. She smiled. Yeah.
She smiled, but she didn't.
Then she'd ask, but she didn't want your answer.
That's right. She said, is it okay? No. Well, it's really felt bad.
Many of us can send two signals simultaneously. You know, I love people, I'm a Christian, but I walk by on the other side. There's my, the two messages that conflict. They're contradictory. And the listener becomes confused. What? He says he's a Christian? And see what he's doing? Someone has said, if the map and the terrain don't agree, trust the terrain. And other people do that as they watch our lives. And we're also sometimes unaware of the nonverbals, that we communicate to other people. When I speak, if I say, California instead of Oregon, I can hear it and I can correct it. But my nonverbal communication, I'm really not aware of it. I think of one of the teachers I hired in Corvallis. He had excellent recommendations, but in his file were two little glitches. One said at times he appears distant, and another one said at times he appears aloof. And so I said to him, would you like to know, after hiring him, would you like to know a couple of little things in here? Yes, he would. So I told him, and he was mad and he was glad. He was mad that people had written those things in there and never shared it with him. But he was glad that someone had finally, because he said, unless I know about it, I can't make any corrections in my nonverbal communication. And I think that you and I oftentimes have a responsibility to our friends and associates to mirror, but not judge, but to mirror objectively, hey, do you know that when someone mentions President Reagan's name, your neck gets red and starts climbing right up like that, and people drop the subject, or whatever it is, because people normally are sincere and wish to try to improve in those areas. Thinking about nonverbals in the family, one example anyway, I was in the San Francisco airport a while ago having dinner. And just over here where I was facing was a table with a father, I assumed a man, and two small children, about age 5 and 7. And they were kind of excited about being out. He ordered, I think it was hamburgers and Coke and such for them. And they would ask him questions, and he didn't respond. He sat kind of looking over their head, smoking a cigarette, and on one occasion when they asked a question, he answered, yup. And that was it. And one time when the little girl saw the packet of sugar on the table and she asked him about that, he ignored her. And non-verbally, in my opinion, that man was saying, you've got my time, I'm here for an hour with you, but you don't mean anything to me. That's what I read out of that particular family situation. I thought that the father's silence shouted, that I don't really care too much about you. That's in contrast, I would have to add, to some of the beautiful, loving care I see by my parents at Holden and the children at Holden here. As a general rule, I think it's, I just kind of sit and think, wow, that's great. Parent, mothers and fathers, arms around children, such as that. Another thing, an 11-year-old girl in California was afraid that her father would ground her for a year for smoking, and she shot herself. She left the note saying, I'm sorry you don't have a daughter anymore. Dad would probably not let me go anywhere for a whole year. I love you so much. but I messed up. Before the father had left for work, he had chastised her severely for smoking. Her note continued, I can't get over the way he walked out of here. I wish we could just forget about it, but it's not that easy. End of quote. Ties into what Joanne said. The way the person said it was really what got to this girl. Anybody know how many teenagers kill themselves every year? 5,000, and the number is going up. What kind of a nonverbal message is that to those of us who confess Christ and who make statements we care about other people? In addition, in the 15 to 19-year-old range, there are about 500,000 attempted suicides a year. And I wonder then how many even consider it, you know, and don't attempt it. And where are these? Are there some in our neighborhood? Are there any in our church family? What responsibility have we to those who are kind of shouting out in a nonverbal way for some care and help? Into the work world and nonverbals. The executive offices of the White House in Washington, D.C., they say, are a fascinating place to observe nonverbal communication. We find, for example, that Diane, who's working there, is getting new carpet, new drapes, and new wallpaper in her office. What does that tell us about Diane's status in the White House? She's on her way up, huh? Bart, we're going to need your office. But we have another one for you. It's down the hall, around the corner, and it's next to the incinerator.
And it doesn't have any windows. Yeah.
What does that say about him? People read these things. At least, you know, the news analysts are watching this all the time. You know, who's getting the bigger office, who's getting the smaller office, because someone is probably on their way out. Now, they expect a resignation, you know, before too long. We can be very insensitive sometimes to rather obvious nonverbal communications. Someone was talking to Sam Goldman, trying to, you know, sell their story to him. And finally, this fellow said, Mr. Goldman, I'm telling you a sensational story. I'm asking for your opinion, and you fall asleep. And Goldman replied, since when isn't my sleeping while you're talking an opinion? Well, in the community, too, there are nonverbal possibilities. Lois and I were in Tiberias a few years ago. We took a boat across the Sea of Galilee to a kibbutz on the other side. On the boat also was a class of grade school students on a field trip. With them were three staff members. Two staff members had a rifle each. The third staff member had an automatic weapon. Well, my nonverbal reading, you know, of that situation, I got several messages. The children might be in danger. The children were precious. And an important one, the community was not going to deny the children the experience of a field trip because there might be some problems. And I kind of contrast that, you know, with our country. If it's possible the school might be sued, what do we do today? Cut that out. Or, you know, cancel programs oftentimes. And I also kind of felt that they were saying that precautions would be taken to protect their youth from this type of danger. What about nonverbals within the church? I guess we could find many of them. There are two I'd like to mention. When I was an adolescent, or I guess younger anyway, when I was a boy, went to a church where there was a large balcony up there. Few people ever sat in the balcony, except maybe Christmas and Easter and times like that. In the very last row of the balcony, I sat and a friend of mine sat. We were non-verbally distancing ourselves as far from the pastor and the pulpit and all up in front as we could. If we'd been a foot more outside or that direction, we'd been out in the sidewalk or up over it. We were kind of expressing some rebellion in the church at that time. Another example that I kind of enjoy. A friend of mine, pastor, a number of years ago in Oregon, had been in a church where he and the choir director just were on opposite, they saw things differently. And she never liked the music that he picked out. So one day, one Sunday came, and he said he had an announcement, some information he wished to share with the congregation. She incidentally had kind of adjusted by the rationalization. I've been here a long time, I've seen pastors come, and I've seen them go, you know, and I'll wait this out. So he announced on Sunday morning once that he had received a call from another congregation, and he paused. Then he said he had considered this very seriously and prayerfully, and he paused a long time. And then he said he had finally decided that he would accept the call. And immediately she broke out at full volume, "Praise God from whom all blessings flow." It's one type of nonverbal. There's another type that you're involved with. If you could look down, you know, where you normally spend your day, if you could hover up above and see where the paths are that your feet would make by walking, by which individuals would your paths normally go, contact? By which individuals would they probably never pass by? And you are, in a sense, non-verbally, what? Rejecting them, leaving them alone, forsaking them and such? Ever thought about that? Those of you particularly who are out working every day, it says something to other people. Particularly if you are a person with some, you know, responsibility or authority in a situation like that. Another community nonverbal that just, I guess it said a lot to me. I was in Dhaka in Bangladesh doing an evaluation of an international school. One day on a road leading to town was a man who was legless, no legs. He was moving toward town. He did not have a wheelchair. He did not have what I thought would be next best, a platform with wheels, you know, where you could push along. This man was rolling from left to stomach to right to back down the side of the road like that. And I said to my friend, I said, you know, what gives? He said every once a week, he goes to his church, or whatever it is, to worship God. And I thought, you know, non-verbally, what did this say about his faith? It is a very poor country, but you'd think, you know, that somebody could help in a situation like that. If you're talking with somebody, let's say you're having an interview, you want to get a job or you want to sell an idea and you're working with a boss or something, and he sits there and he looks right at you, and maybe he leans forward in his chair and he kind of nods a little bit like this, you know, you're feeling pretty good about it. On the other hand, if he sits there and he kind of steeples his fingers like this and looks away, cocks his head, and you tell him something more, maybe he starts throwing his fingers, you know, on the desk, or looking out the window, or rubbing his chin, stifles a yawn, you might as well, you know, bail out. regroup and try some other time. And one other thing about the use of eyes in nonverbal communication. When I was in Bangladesh, a young woman, very slender, frail, rather frail appearing, holding a baby that looked very frail, a very small baby, fell in beside me as I'm walking down here, down the street, road. And her motions, she couldn't speak English, and I couldn't speak her language, but I understood what she wanted. She's walking down like that, and first she gets my eyes, and she holds my eyes, if you know what I mean. You know, she doesn't let loose of them. And then she goes like this. With her fingers, slender fingers, you know, indicating food for the mouth and for the baby. We couldn't talk to each other, but she had communicated very, very clearly to me what she needed. The holding of the eyes, I think, was probably the most significant thing as far as she was concerned there. Remember, Peter learned that when the cock crowed after he denied Jesus, the Lord turned around and looked at Peter. I can almost see the eyes. Can you visualize that? Then Peter remembered the Lord's words and went out and wept bitterly. Our eyes can narrow, they can widen, become alert, overflow with love, fill with tears, which some of us suppress, express disappointment, heartache, all these various things. Ralph Waldo Emerson makes a statement that the eyes say more than the tongue. He says that the dialect of the eyes needs no dictionary whatsoever. It's understood the world over. What type of people do you meet during your days who use their eyes effectively for you in a nonverbal way?
Rogers.
Mr. Rogers? Okay.
Mr. Rogers uses his eyes.
All right. Good, good. Any other type of people? Yeah.
Sometimes judges, I do some courtroom practice, and if a judge kind of rolls his eyes back like that, you know that whatever being said is probably pretty off the wall. Or if they, you know, lean forward and really look and are interested or looking, you know, if their attention is focused, then you know that it may be convincing. But you can tell a lot, or if they're looking around and catching other people's eye, you know that they're saying, do you swallow this, or, you know, pretty far-fetched. So you can tell a lot by looking at their eyes and even their body language, whether they're leaned back or, you know, forward in their chair. Or
good. That's very interesting. I can just see what you're telling me. A judge holding his eyes back like that, he's saying a lot. Yeah. Any other group of people? Yeah.
Well, a very ill person, sometimes they can't speak or even point, but they can look at a glass of water or food or whatever.
They can signal with their eyes. Right. What about an automobile salesman? I find sometimes that they use their eyes very effectively. Or, I guess it's effectively. It's a negative reaction sometimes we get, but that would be another type. Beggars also. What about a hitchhiker? You know, if you're going down, driving down and somebody goes like this and isn't looking at you, you'll be far less than if they get your eyes and they kind of watch you like this. You almost feel like you're guilty for not stopping to pick them up. How about someone who wears dark glasses and you're talking to them? You can't. It's hard to talk to them, isn't it?
No, you can't.
Yeah. You can't see the eyes. Yeah. Yeah, that's the way we feel about it. Well, anyway, when it comes to nonverbal communication, I guess summary is we can't not communicate. You know, if two people are within visual distance of each other, there is some type of communication going on, whether it's rejection or what. In fact, with the eyes again, an interesting thing, studies have shown that people I'm walking this way, and I'm, you know, looking at Margaret, but you get about 8 feet away, and what do? You dim your eyes.
Yeah.
That's about as far as you keep your eyes pointed to somebody. So, Jesus again has said, "My children, love must not be a matter of words and talk. It must be genuine and show itself in action." How many of us, you know, are too good with words? We can quote scripture. We can have intellectual arguments about hunger in the world. We can sit in long committees and deliberate about what needs to be done. We can pass resolutions in conferences and conventions. But we're still asked, you know, are you passing by the other side? Okay, let's shift. Oh, well, let's see. I may not want to shift just at this moment. Let me see if I have anything else. Oh, yeah. On item 25 on the back of your sheet, I'll just kind of summarize with that. We can non-verbally exclude individuals from our group by disregarding them, avoiding them, laughing at them. That's a cruel thing. Looking away from them as they come by, failing to speak to them, failing to look at, smile, respond to them when they need assistance. We can, in effect, excommunicate people. There was a fellow who came to our church, well, I guess now it must be 10 months ago. He looked like a street person. I'm afraid too many of us were happy to see our friends, to the exclusion of this fellow that his name was Dave. Never seen him come back again. Well, maybe he's going through town, I'm not sure. But how easy it is non-verbally to exclude people. Make them feel unwanted and unacceptable. One summary point on this. Years ago, the Chinese, when they wished to punish a wrongdoer, you know what they would do? They would hold a council meeting and declare the person dead. And from that point on, no one was to talk to, look at, or recognize that person. And it wasn't long before they left the village and went away and died. No one killed them, you know, physically. But psychologically, there was kind of a death sentence just by being ignored. Okay, we'll switch a little bit to saying it with a touch. There's a current advertising slogan that some company has about keeping in touch. Do you remember what that is?
Reach
out and touch someone. That's good and bad. I mean, the idea is good, but it lacks the human touch. You know, verbal communication is what they're saying, and that's fine. But I'm talking about the human touch here. In fact, there's an interesting story that deals with the phone and the human touch. A lady did an experiment. She left her coins, you know, in the return slot of the phone and waited until someone else went into the phone booth. And then, you know, she'd come back and she'd say, you know, I left my coins in the phone, may I get them back? When she did that, about 30% of the people let her retrieve the coins. Then she tried something else. The same thing, but when she asked them, she put her hand lightly on their arm. May I get my coins out of the phone? 60% of the people let her get the coins in that situation. The difference apparently was the touch that was there. Our Ashley Montague tells us that our skin is the largest and most powerful sense organ of all. We average 18 square feet of surface with millions of sensory cells. And yet often this touch hunger that we have is ignored. We're deprived of the physical contact, which really says, you know, you're important to me. There was a study made early 1900s. Children who were babies, actually, and small children who were wasting away and dying due to what is called marasmus. Joanne, you tell us what that is?
I can't tell you what it is. But they would just weaken and die, yes.
Yeah, they would just weaken and die. In fact, one-third of them never lived to be a year old. And it was basically due to what, well, they checked out first. They had good medical care, they had good food, they had clean cribs and all that. But the employees, you know, not enough employees, understaffed, and no one was there to hold them, cuddle them, fondle them, talk to them. And so Dr. Renee Spitz from Colorado did a study on this, brought additional women in to hold and stroke and talk to the babies. And due to this increased physical contact, the mortality rate dropped dramatically. Touch deprivation is more than just neglect. It probably equates with being rejected and can have traumatic and fatal results. A member of our church in Eugene is a cuddler. She's a volunteer cuddler at Sacred Heart Hospital. And she goes there several hours, I don't know, a couple days a week or one day a week, and there's a whole schedule of the cuddlers that come in. And you know, they're a premature baby, and maybe the parents live 50 miles away or something, can't be in there all the time. She sits and cuddles the baby for a while. It makes a difference in their existence. I sometimes wonder, too, if our popularity of cuddly soft toys, is in any regard or respect a result of a need for something that the children aren't getting. We'll go down and buy you this cuddly toy, but I'm going to be gone for a week. I don't know. And someone else will have to make that study. How about adults and our need for touch? What do we say many times when we leave somebody? Let's keep in touch. But again, maybe by phone or with eye or something of this nature. And I prefer it the other way. I think you and I know of the untouchables class in India. And one time when we were in the northern part of India, someone hired for us, someone to carry our backpacks down the mountain, and he was a leper. And I guess you can kind of get the feeling. What must it be like to touch people without whole hands and whole bodies? And when it comes to the problem of touching and other people and touch deprivation, some of those who need it the most are those who may not be whole physically. They may be crippled. They may, you know, have other types of challenges and problems. They may be very unattractive individuals. And what's our temptation, you know, to spend time with those that look whole, look more attractive, such as that. Sometimes those who look different, I think. How about the spastic? If a spastic person comes to church, someone in the wheelchair, do they get the same touch, which they probably need more than others? What about the touch of other people? What's the most acceptable touch when you meet another person?
Handshake.
Handshake, yeah. And there are all kinds of handshakes, aren't there? Bart, will you come up here a minute and see whether we can... You know, one type of handshake is this, the antiseptic type, staying about as far away maybe as you can. Good handshake. And I like better putting the other hand on top. Does that feel any different?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe even on the arm, like this. Maybe even like this. There's a lot of difference in there. And just one other example. I had a, this would be a little hard to do with you because you're pretty strong, but my stepfather-in-law was a big Norwegian person, big, and a very friendly, kind-hearted person. And when he shook hands, he'd go, he would draw you to him, and you'd have to plant one foot like this. But there's a lot of difference just in the way you can shake a hand. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, But then there's also maybe kind of a risk in touching, question mark today. It's strange about touching, but some of us probably feared the way we were raised that touching was not quite right. And I think there are touch-deprived youth. But I don't think a family can afford to have touch-deprived children in the family without having some problems later. In India and Egypt, you know, you see women walking down the street holding hands. You see men walking down the street holding hands. It looks funny, I guess, to those who are not used to that.
You know, Ken, I think that's where you have to be real sensitive to what a person's perception of touching is, because I think often that you have to be really aware that that person doesn't mind being touched. I used to say you don't touch the queen or the king. It's a power thing.
Yeah. Okay.
So that, I think some people react very differently to touch based on their culture. And actually, because I married into a Scandinavian family, I found that they stood the distance.
Yeah.
They didn't. But that touching was in a whole different way. There was a communication of touching. And when they touched you, it was so significant.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think if you touch people too often, very casually, it takes away from the meaning of the touch for some of us, not for everybody.
No.
I always say, you know, there's times when that's okay, but you have to be real sensitive to that. In some cultures, that's rude, and in some, they could walk down the street holding hands, and it's fine. So you have to kind of tune in. And also, I think it's a power thing, that probably in the past, women didn't touch men as much as men touched women. Somebody in a wheelchair, people, it's very easy to touch, they can't touch back, so there's that equality kind of thing. So I sometimes think that when we blanketly say we need to touch people more and more, I get a little concerned.
Okay, we'll have to follow that up later. We're in the same church. Because I've erred on the non-touching side, I think, most of my life.
Uh-huh.
And it's been difficult to turn the corner. I'm one of God's frozen people.
Yeah, I want to speak to that too, because I'm not. I'm a toucher.
Uh-huh.
And I am sensitive to what you're talking about. But he's making the point of biological need. And I don't care what culture you're from, that's there. Now, there's this cultural thing that people go through, and even in some cultures that you avert looking in the eyes because that's rude or whatever. But there is a biological need for touch. And I find 99.9% of the time, if I'm sensitive just in general to the human being I'm with, my touch is not taken as a negative, whatever their cultural thing is. And teenagers, absolutely. I feel that one of the reasons for promiscuity and engaging in, non-committal sex, or whatever you want to call it, is partly, in fact, a large response to the need for touch.
I think I just say hallelujah in a way, not enough really. But I think you're right. And I guess I would, if it's 99% of the time is taken well and 1% isn't, I'm going to gamble. If it's 70-30, I'm going to gamble. Now, see. Yeah, one more comment.
Well, I think the meaning of touch has the same capacity for misunderstanding as the meaning of words. That you have there, that we all have a different interpretation of meaning of certain touches.
Good.
We
can go all day, I think, on this. There is a division of the house.
Yeah.
How's that?
Let
me move ahead a little bit with what Joanne started on the cultural differences, because that ties right into this up here, and I won't ask you to guess these, but I will give it to you. Number of touches per hour, couples in restaurants or cafes. Okay, Gainesville, Florida, average of 2. London, less than 1. Paris, 110. San Juan, Puerto Rico, up to 180.
All right.
Number of touches. You know where to go, right? Number of touches per hour in conversation. Huh? You're talking to somebody. In America, less than 3. In France, more than 100. In Scandinavia, more than 100. And I'm going to guess here, this is not official. Being of Scandinavian descent, where my grandfather born in Sweden, my father born in the Åland Islands between Sweden and Finland. Ah, grandfather was up here, you know, Captain Charleston, mustache, and all that. I don't remember him handling me or touching me or anything like that.
Did he love you?
What?
Did he love you?
How do I know?
That's what I was wondering. You didn't know.
I mean, there wasn't the evidence, I should say. Hey, yeah, I mean, sure, I know he liked me. I think they liked me, but love, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay, my dad. Born, and I've been over to where he was born and visited some relatives, and it was quite, I don't ever remember sitting on my dad's lap. I missed that. It was rough. I missed a lot of that. The major memory, unfortunately, was physical contact of a punishment type. And incidentally, as a sideline, I think I have a harder time thinking about accepting a Heavenly Father, loving Heavenly Father. You know, when I have to kind of get around the corner and saying, well, you know, Father image in that situation. And I just have a couple more points, then if we have time, we'll ask for some more ideas here. So I think lack of touching, well, I'm going to share one thing with you here on research. Research suggests the ignored need for touch in our culture may have a negative effect on health. There is an increasing medical evidence that touching is essential to physical as well as emotional health. Lack of touching appears to be a significant factor in stress, anxiety, and illness. Sick individuals who touch and are touched reportedly have a better chance of getting well. And then a quote from Sidney Simon's book, Caring, Feeling, and Touching. Being touched in ways which are respectful, aware, and tenderly full of caring can be healing. One of the most therapeutic things a person can experience. Persistent denial of skin hunger frequently results in depression. People who have their skin hunger needs satisfactorily met are demonstrably far healthier. Quite a statement. Pastor Barbara Lee was here at Holden, I think, last summer. Anybody remember? Or summer before. She had been a chaplain prior to serving in the congregation, and I know you've had a number of these same experiences because we talked about it earlier. She reported in a typical chaplaincy day, she held the hands of 50 individuals of all ages. In the congregation she now serves, many members expect more than a handshake when she greets them after the services. Some refer to those waiting to see her as standing in the hug line. Members have commented to her, "This is the only time we feel free to ask someone to touch us." One man disclosed to Barbara, "This is the first time I've had a hug since my wife died 20 years ago." Well, just a comment or two about pets and touching. Barbara has tapes here. Leo Bustedt has tapes here, as you know, and such. And studies show that when we're in contact with a friend and also with a pet, our heartbeat slows down. Another study of patients who recovered from cancer offered this consistent finding. An exceptionally high number of those who got better were pet owners. The psychiatrist investigating this investigated how we relate to pets in comparison to people. One apparent answer is that animals lavish us with spontaneous acceptance. In return, we touch them unconsciously and unreservedly. And Leo Bustedt, who was a dean of the veterinary medicine at Washington State, stresses that animals as pets seem completely non-judgmental. They'll rub around your legs, jump in your lap, whether you deserve their friendship or not. They're generous nuzzlers and touchers, and they love to be stroked. Bustedt says to have pets is to have a touching experience. Now again, as I suggested, I lacked a lot of touching from my father. Studies show that girl babies are touched more than boy babies. Also that an earlier age of cessation in touching with males. This usually results in more roughhouse contact. I remember, how did I usually, you know, express friendship with somebody? It seemed to be, you know, put them on the arm like that. That was kind of the extent of the touch when we were. Well, and of course, Jesus' example is quite different. Laying his hands upon people, touching lepers, touching all types of people. Are there any other special touching experiences that you would like to share, and where are we now?
It's time.
I've got 22. What
oh,
you
mine's in between 22.
Okay. Yes, would you share?
I'd like to say that if America is in that bad of shape, they better take turns and move to Hawaii for a little. They hug a lot there.
Is that, well, good. That's part of the country now, isn't it? Yes.
One real concern I have, I'm an educator, and they're starting to pass laws about not touching students.
That bothers me. It makes me so sad, and
it's, you know, because of the child abuse thing and the legalities, and you can be accused of all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But I was talking to a teacher one time that taught elementary. I teach high school, but he taught elementary, and he said that before the kids left each day, to put their heads down on the desk and not touch each one. We knew that they at least got one touch. But I think what's wrong with a society that is saying that that's wrong?
That worries me, the lawsuits and stuff.
I think that's a real concern.
Yeah. Well, what I was talking to him about the other day was in nursing homes. I visit nursing homes and private homes at the shut-in. And the first thing I come in to these friends of mine, I have to go and hug them. One day I didn't hug one person when I left. So when I came in the next week, she said, "You forgot something last week." I said, "What did you forget?" "You forgot to give me a hug. You better give it to me right now." Then I had to give it to her again when she left, or when I left. And this, there was two, I told him about this woman and the man, that she is 92 and he is 80. They'd sit out in the hall side by each. And I come in there one day and he had his hand over hers. And I put my hand over the top of his, and I said, "That's the nicest thing that you could ever do," I said, "is holding hands." And I'll swear, now I'm not kidding, it seems to me that they're 10 years younger, and they sit by each other. He invited her to come and sit at his table to eat. And she does, and she always tells me, "Remember now that Ed asked me, I didn't ask him." It's just as cute as can be. I love to go to nursing homes. The people that don't visit nursing homes, I have done this for 14 years, every week, except I'm missing this week, but I had to go two times last week to make up for it. But it is the most gratifying thing you could ever imagine, and it's just that little touch and a hug. And sometimes I'll kiss them. And so this one day I was kissing this man. And so they were sitting in the dining room, and as I was going out, a lady looked at me and said, "You kiss all the men?" I said, "No, I don't. It's just those that I like."
Yeah. Well, I think that's beautiful. I think we're probably going to have to wind up because of the time and the traffic. But briefly then, you know, if we see neighbors dying of hunger, we'll try to do something to feed them. The invisible talk of, you know, feeding people who are starving with skin hunger, we forget about. And the point you just raised, I think particularly the elderly, particularly children, are the ones who are suffering from lack of, you know, contact as far as skin. And those of us belong, you know, to the witness of Christ, I think we have meager justification for not keeping in touch.
I practice a little bit reflexology, and there's one lady that I've been working on her feet quite a bit. I can go into her room, I'll be talking to somebody else, but she starts her wheelchair over to me, and then right in front of me she'll sit until I pick up her feet, kick off her shoes, and give her a little treatment.
That's
great.
Thank you.
Well,
okay, thanks for your time.